I want to thank Danny for asking me. I have been to the Hickory Hills Friday night meeting a couple of times. Love that meeting. I live in Marietta, and traffic going up 575 on Fridays, not the easiest thing for me to get to the 7 o'clock meeting. I would come more, and I keep trying to get my husband to go up there because I don't know how many of y'all have been to that meeting, but the few times I've been, I really like it. So I know from having gone to that meeting that you guys were just friendly up here. And I met Danny at that meeting, and when I saw him at the Allatoona Roundup recently, I remembered him because he did the most phenomenal job of welcoming. You know, in AA, we're supposed to welcome people, and some people are just really gifted at it. And Danny is incredibly gifted, and I remembered him. And so when I saw him at the Allatoona Roundup, I did not know many people, but I knew Danny. So thank you for asking me, and thanks for welcoming us. So the cool thing about doing this is I get to think about my sobriety a little bit and the gifts. And so anytime I'm of service, I get to do that. So, well, before I get started, okay, so my sobriety day is March 7th, 1991. So, and I have a sponsor. She's got a sponsor. I'm supposed to say all those things. And my home group is Sisters Off the Sauce, not of the sauce, Sisters Off the Sauce, which is a really cool name for a group. So it's a women's meeting, and we meet on Thursday nights at 6:30 at the Mount Zion Church in Marietta. So if you're a girl, come on. And Nancy spoke there a couple years ago at our anniversary meeting, and I remember. So thank you. And so as I was getting ready for this meeting tonight, I was sitting here thinking, so I'm not going to go in order. I'm just going to tell you that right now. If I try to go in order, I don't get to the good stuff because I try to get too many details. So I'm just not going to go in order. But I was thinking today, I was thinking, wow, so what would I want to share would be the greatest gifts? So you know what? It was really great. I was having this problem getting ready thinking, well, what is the greatest gift that I've had here? So what a great problem to have when I couldn't figure out what the greatest gift was, right? So if I had to say what the greatest gift, if I had to pick one, I would say a relationship with God, my higher power, because I came in the rooms completely agnostic. I think if you come in the rooms agnostic, that they made a chapter for you, so that means that you just belong. So, but I really came in with an anti-belief, and if you had any kind of Jesus bumper sticker on the car, I just wanted to rear end you. I just was whole. I say, by the grace of God, at my very first meeting, I never heard the word God, because had I heard, and you know what? It's in the steps. So they said it quite a bit, but I didn't hear it. So for that, I am grateful, because I don't know what I would have done. So I am not going to spend too much time in the problem, but I want to qualify. Tell me, how can I qualify? So the only story, well, there's a lot of stories that come to mind, but I don't want to spend too long on it. I started drinking when I was and all those other things. Besides drinking when I was 13, I heard the speaker recently tell this. He said, you know what? If I had known back in the day when I was doing all those outside issues that I wasn't supposed to do that because I was going to join Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe I wouldn't have done them. And I thought, that's a great way to put it, right? I just didn't know that was one of the things. But I know I'm an alcoholic. I know because I drank alcoholically. And I didn't know that going into my first treatment center. But I'll back up for a minute. So I started when I was 13, but there's one memory that just keeps coming to my mind, and it's not a pretty memory, and an alcoholic in his cups, it isn't pretty. And women alcoholics are not very attractive or very ladylike, and at all. And so I have a memory of near the end, I like to say it's the last time I drank, but it wasn't. I had been at this party all night, and I had gotten really wasted, and towards the end, I had never been a crying drunk. I was a happy drunk. I was your cocktail waitress kind of drunk. I was a cocktail waitress, and I worked in bars. I loved bars. I loved bartenders. Bartenders would make drinks named after me that were pink. It was great. And so I was the happy, but towards the end, There was a lot of depression, I guess. And so I'd get drunk, and then I would start crying sometimes. So I'd been at this party at a friend's house, and I started crying, and my boyfriend was there, and he's like, let's go home. And I curled up in a ball. I didn't want him to touch me. Didn't want anybody to touch me. And they took my keys away because they didn't want me to drive. And it was just not a pretty night. And so, and I don't black out much. I call them brownouts. You know, I don't usually have nights that I didn't remember at all. There'd just be pieces of it. And that might have been because of some of those outside issues I was doing. But I remember the next, they had tried to get me to eat something. They had tried to force feed SpaghettiOs to me.
Oh, God.
And I don't know what I'd been drinking, but it was plenty, plenty, plenty. So, and I didn't wear a lot of clothes back then either. So there's a lapse of time, but then I kind of remember kind of coming to, and it's the next morning, and it's during the work week, and it's rush hour traffic, and I didn't have a day job. And I'm walking down the road in a long hippie skirt, probably barefoot, with a white little shirt on, like off the shoulder, always midriff showing, and SpaghettiOs spilled down the front. And I'm stumbling down the road because they've taken my keys in rush hour traffic. And thankfully, somebody who was on their way to work, who I partied with, saw me and was like, "Hey, Lisa, do you need a ride?" Because obviously I needed a ride. And so that's, to me, that I can see that picture of me doing that. And that's not a pretty picture. You know, I'm 20 years old. I'm stumbling home in rush hour traffic because even the people I'm partying with won't let me have my keys. I can't go home with my boyfriend, who I live with, because I'm so emotionally upset that I'm just get away from me. And that's just not a happy place. So, you know, it talks in the book. And so I was at this meeting with Danny on Saturday night, and they read a lot. And one of the words that came out in the meeting that really struck me was the word alcoholic torture. And it talks about that in the doctor's opinion. And I thought, you know, I've read the doctor's opinion numerous times, but I don't remember really thinking about the word torture. So I sat there and reflected on that during the meeting. So always before I thought about it, and I even shared Sarah and I a little bit about it. So always before I tell my story, the morning, so I did really good this time. I didn't think about it all week. I didn't think about it all month. By the grace of God, I didn't think about it much till today. So, but every time before I tell my story, what I do is I'll get up and I'll pray and I'll open the big book. And I'm like, okay, God, just let's open it somewhere and let's see where I open it to. And so usually I start with this. So I'm going to, this is what I opened up to. And it always, every time I open it up, it's like, no, God, I really don't like that page. And then I'm like, okay, I'll read it anyway. So this is a first edition, I guess. The page numbers are wrong, is all I know. It was a wedding gift. If you stay sober long enough, you'll get a big book as a wedding gift. So this is from the story called The Unbeliever. And I'm just going to read this part of the paragraph. It says, "What was it he said? Oh, yes. Came in and told me about his terrific drunks, his trips up here, the same thing I'm going through. Yes, he's an alcoholic, all right. And then he told me he knew he was cured. Told me he was peaceful. I'll never know peace again. And he didn't carry constant fear around with him. Happy because he felt free. But it's screwy. He said so himself. But he did get my confidence when he started to tell what he had gone through. It was exactly like my case. He knows what this torture is. He raised my hopes so high it looked as though he had something. I don't know. I guess I was sold. I guess I was so sold that I expected him to spring some kind of pill and ask him desperately what it was. And he said, God. But anyway, it was when I opened this morning, and that was it. I said, there's that word torture again. So then I thought, so that story of me walking down the street, you know, SpaghettiOs on that skimpy white blouse and rush hour traffic. So that wasn't pretty, but the feelings, you know, so there's lots of different things I could share from my past and my drinking history that are funny and sad and scary and everything else. But the things that we have in common are those feelings. So that torture, so the feeling for me, the biggest torture was that I had no self-respect. I didn't like me. I did not like the person I had become, so much so that working in bars, I did what any good alcoholic does, get a real fake ID, because I was, all of my drinking was underage, mostly, because I got sober when I was 21. So I went through this, isn't that funny? Legal, who cares now? So don't go through this, well, I'm an alcoholic, I care. I went through a stack of driver's licenses, and I still remember her name. It was a woman who was a drinking age, and her name was Amanda Gardner Upchurch. And she had blonde hair. She looked like she had no makeup on, and she had a flannel on. She looked real earthy in this picture. And I picked her because she was 21, and she had blonde hair and looked somewhat like me. I needed a fake ID. But as I got a hold of that fake ID, my self-loathing was such that, even though I had never met Amanda, I was convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that she was such a better person than I was. You know, she had to be, because I did not like me at all. I would have killed myself. As a matter of fact, I remember before I first started going to meetings, I remember one time thinking, you know what, if this is all there is, and this is, I've concluded at 20, because I was wise at 20, that this is all there was, and I remember going through the house and looking through the medicine cabinets to see if there was enough in there to take, just to go. And I went through the medicine cabinets, and I realized there's not enough to take me out. So I never tried to commit suicide, but I always hoped that that would just accidentally happen, because I just wanted to check out. So I'll flash forward. So in early sobriety, one of the gifts, some of the gifts have come, I believe they're gifts from my higher power in dreams. So I remember early sobriety, that feeling of self-loathing just didn't leave like that. And I remember still kind of wishing in the beginning that, you know, this just checking out would be easy. And I had a dream. It was very vivid. And this is a long time ago. This dream was 27 years ago, and I had a dream that somebody was chasing me with a gun. It was night, and I was outside, and there was a lot of cars, and I was in a parking lot. And I dreamt that I got away from this person, I thought, and I hid, and I remember I was crouched down beside a car, beside the tire, and I thought I'd gotten away, and then all of a sudden, the killer comes behind me with his gun, and I'm crouched over, and he points the gun at the back of my neck, and he shoots. And it was vivid to the point, I've never been shot. I don't have a gun. I'm not a gun person. But the dream was so vivid that I could feel the bullet echo in my belly. And as I'm sitting there in my dream, I realized, wow, that was a good hit. And I'm not going to live through this. And I woke up realizing I'm not ready to die yet. You know, so that dream was a gift. It's like, okay, you know what? I don't want to check out yet, which was a big deal for me, because I can remember the last time I picked up a white chip. So I picked up a lot of white chips. I wanted this thing, but it was hard to get sober without any tools. And that's what, you know, so the steps I'm so grateful for, because not only are they tools for me to get sober by, but they're tools for me to live a happy and joyful life. But in the beginning, I just couldn't get them fast enough without taking a drink, I guess. And you know what? How willing was I? I don't know. I wasn't that willing. But I came back in the last time. I went through 3 treatment centers by the time I was 21. I'll tell you the first meeting I went to, I said I didn't hear God. I had a boyfriend for a couple years, and I knew he had a problem. It was very evident to me. I told him he had a problem all the time. I would point my finger at him, and I would say, "You have no morals." And I know now the reason I said that to him was because I didn't have any, but I could see so clearly in him. But I was always good at finding people that were worse than me, so I didn't look as bad. So, and I was just so proud of me. I qualify for the other sister program, too, because my goal was to keep him out of the morgue and the hospital. And his friends complimented me on how I did a pretty good job of that. And jail, most of the time. But there was one time, and we went to a wedding, and it was an open bar. And it's the only time I can ever remember my drinking history that I got so loaded that I called a cab, but I was so loaded I couldn't get to the cab. So, you know, how well does that go? So anyway, so he drove us home, and I was in this really formal dress, and all I remember is the next day, my stepdad woke me up, and he'd been trying to wake me up for hours. He's like, Hudson was his name. Hudson is in jail, and he got arrested for DUI. You need to go get him. You know, what a dysfunctional family I live in. So my boyfriend and I live with my stepdad. My stepdad is encouraging me to wake up out of my drunkenness to go bail him out. Hudson, by the way, didn't have a driver's license or a car. So he had taken my car as well as my wallet. So I proceeded to do what any good partner in crime would do, and I call his brother, get the money, borrow a car, go down there, and while I bail him out, proceed to throw up in between signing papers. But flash forward, so the very first, so he got out of jail, and while he was, I got him out, and then he instead of having a longer sentence, he opted for treatment. Back in the day, that was an option. Treatment? That was North Carolina. So he went into treatment, and this is when I did try to stop. He went into treatment, and I thought, okay, I'm 20 years old. I think I love this guy. I've been with him a couple of years. He seems to really want to get sober. God knows he needs to get sober. I'll quit. I'll just quit. And I made that conscious decision to quit. And I remember very consciously doing this next action. So forgive me for just steering off of singleness of purpose for a moment. For whatever reason, we did smoke a lot of that stuff that you're not supposed to smoke. And we had saved a lot of the seeds. We were just talking about lemon trees. We had saved a lot. I don't know why we were saving all these seeds, but we had a bag of seeds. Now, they don't flush well. So I just remember, like, taking an hour to flush all the seeds. So because I had made a decision. I'm done. I got rid of all the paraphernalia, flushed all the seeds, got rid of everything, and that was it. I was done. And this is where that alcoholic insanity comes in. I don't remember how long I made it, but I know it wasn't 48 hours. And I don't remember why I picked up a drink, because I had made a decision. I had never before decided, that's it, I'm going to quit. But I completely decided I was going to quit. And then I'm like, wait a minute, how am I drinking again? You know, and that's that insidious disease. And I remember telling my stepdad later, I think it's hysterical, I said, I'm not going to drink when I need to drink. I'm just going to drink what I want to drink. And that made total sense to me, right? Made total sense. So anyway, I took him to, so when he got out of treatment, the point is I got to my very first meeting, and that first meeting, I took him because he lost his driver's license. And it was a meeting in North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina, and when we pulled up, it was all motorcycles out there. And I walk in, I'm 20 years old, and I wore a lot of pink to try to make people think I was innocent, so I had on my pink shirt. And I had on a pink shirt with sleeves that were at least this long to cover up any marks that would be in my arms. And so I walk in this room, and there's a whole bunch of guys in leather. And I don't remember any girls being in there. I don't remember. And I'm just taking him because he needs a ride to a meeting. And I sit in there, and that very first meeting, because I had tried to quit drinking when he was in treatment, and I couldn't. And I realized, oh, wow, I can relate. And I picked up a white chip that very first night. Now, I'd love to tell you it worked, that, you know, I wasn't done yet. But that very first meeting I went to with all guys, all bikers, all 20 years older than me, it was like, oh, wow, I could relate. So that was a gift. So I did a little bit of writing this morning. I journal sometimes, and when I journal, I write to God. So talking about that torture again. So I said, you know, I hated me. It was me against the world. I had no hope. I wished for the end. I had an inability to control my drinking and anything else. I would usually go through about a lot of jobs. I always say I never got fired, and then it dawned on me, well, I got fired all the time. I just never showed up for it, right? Because I would go through many restaurant jobs, because if the party wasn't over, I just didn't go to work. I'm going to contrast that with today. So today, I know that there is a solution. I know that I can always call someone who will understand and care. So I relapsed quite a bit. So I remember in early sobriety, during one of those relapses, I'm at a bar, and I'm drinking, and there's this guy sitting next to me that I don't know. And I had been in the rooms long enough that I had learned that I could talk to you guys, and you would listen to me, and you cared, and it was awesome. So when I'm at this bar, and this guy, I'm trying to start telling him some of my problems, and he's like, honey, you just need another drink. Right? But what that was is, after having been in the bed of AA in your guys' arms, in the love, and then that going away, and because I'm drinking, I can't call you. Well, I could, but you're going to tell me to go to a meeting, right? And that's not what I wanted to hear right then, but it was so lonely, because I had for the first time ever, in early sobriety, before I was relapsed, is I had that moment of, or not that moment, I had those months of people really cared. Because, you know, we would do anything for each other. we would do anything for each other. I'm just going to say this because I thought of it this morning when I was thinking of this too. So, because, you know, and so recovery is not always perfect. I get to sponsor women. And so there was a couple that I was talking to Saturday. We were walking on Kennesaw Mountain. See, I get to do this. I get to go to Kennesaw Mountain. I get to walk outside with women and share and laugh. And talking about how, you know, it'd be great if recovery was like that mountain. My recovery just does not go up in that nice slope. You know, my recovery is like this. And sometimes it's like this, you know. And so it was like this. So about 3 years sober, I fell head over heels with this guy that I met in the rooms, you know, boy meets girl on AA campus. Woohoo! And I can't outdo Nancy here, though. but I did. I moved for this man and everything else. And there were so many clues that it was just a bad relationship. And anyway, I moved. I changed colleges. And then I find out after I moved that he had been in a relationship the whole time with another woman in the program. And so this woman, he had been in another relationship. I move, and this other woman who's watching all this, who's been sober for a while, she looks at me, she says, "You really don't know, do you?" Now, I didn't know because I didn't want to know, right? But the whole point that I'm getting at is that how much we love each other. So I found out he was seeing somebody else, and the first thought was that I should set his house on fire, and I thought about that for a while. And I didn't do it. I think I went over there and looked to see if there was anything easy to catch on fire. Didn't do it. You know, called my sponsor, freaked out. I freaked out. But it took me less than a month. I'm going to say within 2 weeks, because that other woman that he was in a relationship with, I'm not saying she and I became best friends, because we didn't. Obviously, this relationship I was in, that pretty much dissolved it. But I was able to have compassion for her. And I remember at 3 years sober thinking, you know what? She and I probably have a lot in common because he's dating her and me. And she's in recovery too. And I thought, you know what? I'm really mad at him. But she's another woman in AA. And if she called me and she wanted to drink, I would still be there. You know what I mean? Because that's what this program's about. You know, that's the most important, because that we're there for each other. I need to keep an eye on time. 7:29. I sent a friend a prayer. She said she's praying for me. So, all right, we're all good. Shelly's praying for me. So, I'll tell you, in early recovery, I didn't take all the suggestions. As I tell you, recovery just wasn't a straight slope for me. As a sponsor, I'm learning how to let the women that I sponsor go through. You know, in early recovery, I think, you know, as a newcomer, I needed a lot of guidance. I remember I would... Back in the day, I called on a payphone, you know, and I would keep those phone and address books with me. And I would call my sponsor a lot because I needed a lot of help in the beginning. And there's this one woman I sponsor today, and she's helping me to learn to let go of this, because, you know, you don't know what mistakes I need to make. So I look back. So in early sobriety, I did not follow all the suggestions. So when I picked up my first year chip, I walled it up, and I was 9 months pregnant and single. Everybody just gasped and held their breath, right? You know, and so that wasn't following all the suggestions. That would constitute a major change, having a child, right? And so Dustin was born a month after I picked up that year chip. And, you know, so even though I didn't follow the suggestions, God is good. And so I remember now, looking back as a single mom, because I was a single mom for a long time. I didn't get married the first time until he was in fourth grade. So that means that, first time. So that means there was 10 years, so I was sober 10 years before I got married the first time. And I remember when he was like one and two, and I was single, and I was in school, and I was poor, I was tired of being broke. And gosh, maybe if I had a relationship or if I got married, maybe I wouldn't be so broke. But that wasn't what it was. But, you know, so I didn't get sober for him because I didn't get pregnant and get sober. As a matter of fact, by the grace of God, I didn't find out I was carrying him until I was 6 months sober. I had two pregnancy tests from a clinic come back negative. And you know, that was God doing for me what I couldn't do. Because I'm just going to tell you right now, my past and my history. And because by the time I found, and the way I was flipping relationships in early sobriety. So by the time I found out I was pregnant with him, I was in my second trimester. So God said, "There shall be Dustin." And so I look back in early sobriety, and that's where I don't know what's best for other people, because I don't know what's best for me either, because I wanted to take care of him, and I knew I couldn't do it if I didn't take care of me. So it was motivation to take care of me. And there was that time, you know, when he was maybe 9 months old, where I thought, you know, it'd be nice to kind of go out and party right now. But going out and partying with a 9-month-old at home with no money for a babysitter, that's just a little bit challenging. You know, so maybe if I'd had 30 days, that'd have been different. You know, but with a year and a half or whatever in a little one at home, it's like, well, I got to stay here and take care of him. I didn't have to. But you know what? I look back and I think that God gave me that gift. That he was my angel back then. I didn't say sober for him, but it did help. You know, it was something that I needed. So I don't know what's best for other people. So I did marry. So when I got 10 years sober, I'd gone back to college because I dropped out of high school my junior year. So I'd gone back to college. I had decided I was going to save the world. So I got a job. I got a job teaching at-risk middle school kids. Didn't save the world. Just want you to know that. But so I'd been 10 years sober. I had a child in elementary school. Bought my first house. I had never mowed a yard before, and I didn't know how. So I wanted a husband to mow the yard. So and I was in a bad space. I'm going to tell you, at 10 years sober, I was not in a good space because I had gotten depressed because I'm like, I've done all this, and how come I don't have this relationship? Because I believed beyond a shadow of a doubt that getting married was going to fix this. Because I wanted a son. I wanted my son to have that father figure. Now, he had debt. He was in recovery. But he and I did better when we didn't live together. So I wanted him to have one at home. So I wanted a husband that would take care of me financially, that would be there for my son, and that would mow the yard. So, and you know, be careful of self-will, because you know, it just doesn't work out that well. So I remember I was at my home group, which should be a safe place. Except when your gut says, oh my God, don't do that. Don't marry him less than 6 months later. Right? I saw him and my gut said, run the other freaking way. And I married him in less than 6 months. And it was a hot mess. He had his own landscaping company, but because I was a teacher and I had summers off, he wouldn't mow the yard. And I know, right? And he had a motorcycle and boat habit, so all the money, there it went. I almost lost the house. And he and my son, it was a hot mess. As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you that with 10 years sober, I had defects come to my house a second time because he was being inappropriate with my son. And he was so. What I had done is I had married someone who was physically violent with 10 years sober because I was convinced, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that was going to fix my problems, right? And so everything I wanted, I didn't get. Everything that I wanted out of that marriage, I got the exact opposite. And that lesson in self-will was the most profound self-will lesson I've had in sobriety. Because that hurt like hell. That, you know, because I was 30 years old. So I thought, you know, I'd waited to get married. You know, I'd known him for, and everybody told me not to do it. As a matter of fact, the guy I asked in AA to give me away refused. Might be a sign, right? And you got to get a backup giver awayer. But so that was a life lesson. So, you know, I know that in recovery I can self-will something, but I did, you know what, I learned a lot. It was the darkest point in my sobriety, but I learned a lot. And I got divorced and made amends. And so that story, so I'm going to flash ahead till today. So I've been married only 3 times. 3's the charm, right? And so my second marriage was also someone in recovery. What I learned is that I married men that as soon as they met me, they quit going to meetings. I think I was trying to fix them, and I can't. So my second husband, now it got better, though. My second husband was he and my son had a good relationship. They still have somewhat of a relationship. And he was there for me with a lot. And he was there for me when my son's father died. I will tell you, that was hard. When my son was 13, his dad, who I'd met in the rooms in early sobriety, he accidentally overdosed. Which 13 is a bad age, right? And I remember the powerlessness, and I remember the pain that I felt because my son was close to his dad. And it was just like, I'm looking at my son, and I'm like, there's nothing I can do. I can't fix this one. It's not that I can't do anything, right? There's nothing I can do. But I did the best I could. I did the best I could do at that point. I was trying to help him develop a relationship with God. And so some women in my home group, there was a woman that had three boys, and their boys went to a youth group. So I just remember going to this youth pastor and saying, I can't fix this. You know, his father has passed. Please, please, please help. So I reached out for help. But the other thing I did, I remember going to an AA meeting, and I remember being so angry. I was so angry because I did not realize that his father had relapsed. And this is God. This is another thing God doing for me, what I couldn't do for myself. What I didn't realize, Dustin was 13 when his father passed, accidentally overdosed. So the year before that, there was one year I had actually let him go live with his dad, just that year right before he passed, because I was trying to sell the house and I didn't want to have to change his school. Now, had I known that his father was actively using, there is no way I would have ever done that. No way. I thought his father just had depression issues. His father took a lot of medication for depression, so I thought that's what it was. And I'm so grateful that God didn't let me know that, because you know what my son got to be? He got to be with his dad that last year without me being an absolute psycho mother. And I'm so glad I didn't. So I look back and I think, you know, God's got this great plan for everything like this. And there's nothing in my recovery that has been so... sometimes it seems like the more tragic it is, the more God can work it out. The more tragedy, the more God has to work with, the more I can let go of it. So so flash forward. So my second ex-husband, when he got sober again, and the cool thing was it was a very amicable separate. As a matter of fact, I can text him. I rarely do, but we every once in a while, I just sold a house that he and I lived in for a long time. And I said, it's finally sold. Yay, thanks for helping me fix the floor. So we sold it. Oh, I sold it recently. And the cool thing was after he got back in the rooms, we didn't have to fight, and we didn't fight that much anyway. And part of his amends to me was coming over, and we were able to work on the house together. And put it so that I rented it out for a long time while I lived there. So that's another gift, I guess, of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you get to do that. So I'm going to tell a story about my grandmother, because this is my favorite, one of my favorite stories, and it talks a lot about amends. I haven't talked much about the steps, have I? Well, I'm definitely an alcoholic. When I came in here, I didn't believe there was a God, and that would be the greatest thing I have now. Sometimes I'm in self-will, and that hurts. Well, you know, before I talk about my grandmother, I'll talk about four for a minute. So when I had about 17 years sober, 18 years sober, I saw that after my second divorce, I was having some issues with relationships, and so did my sponsor. So she pointed out in the big book that there it talks about doing sex inventory. So she concluded that it would be good for me to make a list of all of my relationships, all of my relationships from the beginning. And that included even Paul Burroughs, who I didn't formally date, who I just made out with at a party when I was 13. So she wanted an exhaustive list, right? So it was a long list, and I got to go through and make that list and look for patterns. And I had done inventories before in recovery, but this four-step was different. And this four-step I'd been around for a while, and this four-step what I got to see is when I put all those relationships down, including the make-out parties from when I was a teenager, is that one of the things they had in common was that I was always looking for what I could get instead of what I could bring to a relationship. What can I get out of this? And that was huge. And then I get to the amends part. And I remember sitting in my old home group, and my old home group was in Buford, and John who's gone to the big meeting in the sky, John O. I can say his last name now, right? John O'Toole. I don't think I know him. He had been sober for a long time. And I was sitting in that meeting, and I was really struggling because I didn't want to make the amends because I had a lot of pride and ego. And I'd been sober for a long time, and I see some of this, and I need to go back and make those amends to my ex-husband, number two and number one, and lots of others. And I said, I don't want to make these amends. And this wise guy in my home group, John, said, you know, he says, well, these are the steps, and we work these steps because if we don't, then we're going to drink and die again. It doesn't matter how long I've been sober. It's just that's what I'm supposed to do if I want to stay sober. And that's what I needed to hear. And that was what helped me to finally get off my butt and be willing to go make those amends. So the cool thing was when I made those amends to my second ex-husband, I said, you know what? I was wrong. I was wrong and one of the biggest things I was wrong in that relationship was when I had committed to make time for he and I to spend time together, I didn't honor it at the end. I said, this is our time. And then when that time came, I did what I wanted to do because I was selfish and self-centered. And you know what? The gift of these tools and the gift of this program, you know what he said to me? I said, so how can I make amends to you? Because that's what I was told. This is what I did wrong. Write it on a card. Now, how can I make amends to you for this? And you know what he said? He said, don't do it to anyone else. And you know what? That is such a gift. And that's so hard. And I would love to stand here and say that I'm so good at that. But, you know, I can tell you that I'm not perfect at that. But I am compelled and willing to do the best I can do and ask God to help me with that. Because, you know, I'm married again. And this time I can say when I got married, I wasn't desperate and looking. I had decided, you know what I think the secret is? To finally be like, I don't want anybody else. I'm done. No, I'm done. I'm going to be single forever. That's it. My picker is broken. And So this is why. I was trying to trust God. I was at a meeting last night, and they were talking about trusting God. So right before I left home, so before we got married, my husband's name is Sean. We've only been married about 3 years. But I really want to do it different. Now, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not perfect. And I come to these meetings because I need reminders all the time. But I wrote this letter, and this is hanging in our bedroom. So this is, in the family afterward chapter, it talks about We needed to live by the principle of giving. I'm not quoting this right. Giving instead of getting. Talks about giving. So, this is what I wrote to him. With your actions, you show me what it means to truly give of oneself. He is much less selfless than I am. You inspired me to be more giving and less selfish. I vow to think less of me and more about you. Your needs, your happiness, and well-being. Okay, maybe I should have vowed that. Maybe I should have just vowed, pray, and ask for grace for that. because that, so I went into this marriage, and I have to remind myself of that. I guess that's why I was hanging on in the bedroom, because instead of thinking about me, like, we just sold this house. So we made a little bit of money, and we paid off some debt. So I'm catching myself right now, thinking, okay, so what can I spend? There's a Polly Pistol. I don't know if you've heard of her. She's got this thing online. It's a relationship workshop, and they talk about money, and they said, if your goal is to be to ensure that your significant other gets at least their 50%, instead of trying to make sure that you get your 50%, then you'll probably both be pretty happy. So I need to pray for that one, because I was doing pretty good with that until we just sold the house, and this money came about. It's like, oop, I need to revisit that one. So it's all talking about steps 8 and 9, though. So a couple years ago, 3 years ago, before we got married, my grandmother lives in Arizona. My mother lived in Arizona. And my grandmother is widowed. And she helped me a lot in early sobriety. As a matter of fact, the last time when I finally got sober, I had been living in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I made that geographical cure to come here to Atlanta to get sober. And moving to Atlanta didn't get me sober. But moving in with my grandmother did give me a place to go that was safe, and she paid for treatment, and she bought me a car, and she did everything she could for me, and I eventually did get sober. So anyway, she went on a trip to, I don't know, all over Europe, and she's older. She's, I don't know, grandma's 87 now. I'm 48, and so she's traveling, and she fell, and she fell and she shattered her shoulder. She ended up in intensive care in Istanbul, Turkey. And she's widowed, and she's on this cruise with a good friend of hers. Okay, I'm going to try not to roll my eyes and judge this woman. But anyway, this woman went all along the cruise while my grandmother was in intensive care. So my grandmother doesn't speak Turkish, by the way. She's never been there before, and she's there alone in this hospital. Now, this is such a great story, because this is going to talk about AA. How am I on time? Okay, I'm good. This is a good story. So I'm not an international traveler, by the way. I'm not. I'm a cocktail waitress slash recovering a teacher slash librarian now. So she's not doing well, and we're trying to get her medevaced out, you know, like fly her out of there, because she's got good insurance. But when they did the surgery on her shoulder, she has heart issues, and then she wasn't stable enough to fly out. So, and she's there maybe, I don't know, in the hospital maybe 5 days, and she's not doing well. And she's not getting a lot better. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, my grandmother's going to, imagine dying alone in a foreign country where you don't know anybody. And so, my mother doesn't travel. And my uncle didn't go. And so, I'm like, well, I'm going to go to Istanbul. If I was like, you're crazy, you just can't go to Istanbul. I'm like, well, yeah, you can. So you get a clearance letter because you got to have a level of security. And thank goodness this was happening 3 years ago instead of now, right? And but here's what I did. I was at work one day, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm just so worried about my grandmother. And on my phone, I Googled AA English-speaking AA meetings in Istanbul. And you know what? Bam. First thing, I hit it, right? What is his name? Randy. I can't remember his name now. Anyway, so I hit the page, and there's a guy, Russell. Russell was his name. And I see a phone number, and I text him. And I say, I'm thinking about coming to Istanbul. Want to make sure you guys got meetings out there. He replies right back. Like the hand of AA, right? So now, This was amazing because I started a dialogue with him and we emailed back and forth because it took a couple of days to get up to make definite plans to go out there. And I communicated to Russell how concerned I was about my grandmother because she's alone. She doesn't speak the language and her blood pressure is doing really poorly. And even to fly out there, it just takes a while to get there, right? So this man who was, I think he had like a year sober. And he was there teaching English, and he didn't have any money, and he didn't live near the hospital. And he took a cab about an hour away from his place, and he was from England, and he bought her some Turkish Delight candy, and he went and visited her in the hospital for like an hour before I got there. Now, like, that's like, wow. Like, that's service work, like, on steroids, right? Right? He'd never met me, but he could. So then I get there, and I'm not an international traveler, so I don't realize that I need some kind of adapter to charge my phone, right? Because you need some kind of weird adapter to charge your phone. But I text him, and he's like, I'll take you to a meeting, and then we'll pick up an adapter. And somebody was talking about how meetings were different. You would not believe how similar the meetings in Istanbul are more like ours than the ones in Boston. I'm just going to tell you right now. It was just like, it was in a church, and it was like it looked like a Methodist church or something, which seems like there's tons of AA meetings in Methodist churches. And it was normal, and it was a normal meeting. And everybody there spoke English, because I remember I Googled the English. I had enough sense to Google English speakers meetings. And they took care of me. I was there maybe 5 or 6 days. And so, and I didn't have a car. Oh, the story gets better. So when I land in Istanbul, though, before I get to the hospital, I'm waiting for my luggage to come around. Now, my only plan is, this is a great plan, because I don't have a lot of time in preparation for this, is to go to the ticket counter or wherever to exchange money and call a cab to get to, because I had the address of the hospital. That's my whole plan. That's not a great plan, but that's as good as I could do, right? And it was a lot of flight changing and everything, and I'm sitting there, and I'm half asleep because it took a while to get over there. And I'm watching the luggage, and I don't see my luggage, and I'm half asleep. And this guy comes up next to me, and he said, weren't you on the plane leaving Atlanta? And I said, yeah. And he said, what are you doing here? So I tell him, well, I'm here to see my grandmother in the hospital. He says, He says, our luggage is lost. I says, and I have a driver. And he says, and I will go over there since I speak Turkish and you don't. He lives in Sandy Springs. And he says, then I'm going to help you fill out the paperwork to get your luggage. And then my driver's going to take you to the hospital. And he walked in the end of the hospital. He made sure that he talked to the staff there to get me there. He even called me the next day to make sure that I got my luggage. Like, so God was taking care of me the whole time, right? And so anyway, but the best part of the story is, so I'm there with my grandmother, and I love my grandmother, but I don't come from a touchy-feely family, all right? I just don't. I come from a very dysfunctional family, and, well, I guess, I don't know. I just don't come from a touchy-feely family, right? And there have been a lot of issues, and I'll tell you, when I sat in early meetings, I remember she was so mad I was pregnant and unwed, and I remember sharing the meetings, I hate my grandmother, I want to kill her. So this is a big transformation, right? This is so very different now, and I'm sitting there, and the whole experience made me realize how much I loved my grandmother, right? And it made me realize how much she had done for me, because she did a lot for me. In early sobriety, you know, she sent me a car from Arizona, you know. She paid for some of my school, you know. So she did a lot for me. And I'm sitting there, and I realize that, and then I want to say it to her, and I can't do it. And I found some kind of app that you could text back home to the U.S., and I'm texting my sponsor saying, you know, I just wish I could say this, and I don't have the courage to say it, and I'm just going to write her a letter. And it was the last night before she was getting released from the hospital. And about that time I sent that text, my grandmother opens the door for that conversation. And she tells me things that I've never heard before, and she tells me that everybody told her to give up on me, because I had been in and out of treatment center so much, and that there was no hope for me, and that she really, really, you know, that she believed in me, and that she loved me, and that she knew it would be okay. And what I didn't realize, though, is that after being sober for more than 20 years, that I needed to go to Istanbul to make amends to my grandmother. You know? And so I'm so grateful for that. So we got to have that conversation. And she's still living today. And she lives in Arizona. Yeah. The end of the story, though, is that we got her back on the plane. And she went back to Arizona. And I had a plane to come back to Atlanta. And it didn't leave for about, I don't know, 12, 16 hours later. Now, the hospital in Istanbul was wonderful to me. They gave me a nice little bed that I stayed in the room with her. They fed me for free. I will tell you that they took amazing care of me in the hospital. But once she was released, I didn't have a room anymore, right? But Russell and the people in AA, they took shifts with me. So they met me at the airport after her flight left. And then one person had me for, like, Russell had me for like 4 hours before he had to go to work. And then Russell turned me over to somebody else, and they took me to a meeting. And then after the meeting was over, they took me out for coffee and showed me some of the sights in Istanbul before they took me to the airport. So, you know, it was just like being in God's hands the whole time. You know, it was such a gift, and it's a good story of AA. I always think of the story. There's a friend I work with, she's not in the program. It's just another example of what AA does and how it is such a blessing. I became phobic with job interviews. I used to do really good at job interviews, and then I got real desperate with that second divorce when I was desperate for money, and I got nervous, and I bombed the first interview, and then I went in the second interview 6 months later and bombed it even worse, and I became phobic, and then I was petrified. And they told me, Lisa, you need to practice. You need to role-play interviewing. Now, who wants to role-play interviewing? Nobody wants to role-play interviewing. But after being, you know, beat into submission, I finally, because I had gotten this degree, I went back and I got a degree to become a librarian. And the story, I gotta wrap this up. The story was that this woman who I worked with, she found out that I role played with a whole bunch of people, and then I went in and I did really good and I got the job. And I remember her telling me, because she knew a little bit about the program, she knew just a little bit, she was one of the few people I worked with that knew that, and she's like, you know what, she said, first of all, she said, I can't imagine having friends that would do that for you. And then she said, I can't imagine being humble and willing enough to do that. So the cool thing is that now it's something that, you know, you give it away. So I have been very motivated. I love to work with women who are going for a job interview. And I'm really good at it. I have a good track record. I'm not saying like, it's not like, but I lose, you know, because I'm passionate about it, because I have that experience, strength, and hope. It's something that I get to give away. So I'll share this. This happened. I got the best compliment this morning. So I have a lot of insecurities about work, and if I open up my God box, I'm going to tell you right now, I am saddened and amazed and angry that the amount of stuff in my God box, it has to do with work. It just does, because I have some insecurities, and my alcoholism's come out at work. And so there's this job. I had a boss, and he quit, and so there's this new position that I could apply for, but it looked scary, so I didn't want to apply for it. But this other girl I work with, same level as me, I said, Shannon, you should apply for that. And I told her, I'm not going to apply for it. So anyway, so this whole thing, she applied for it. And I even encouraged her to apply for the job she's in now. I've encouraged her to do a lot of different things. But going back to that whole thing with they giving it away. So without making this a long story, someone referred me to a career coach, this woman who's trying to get her certification. So because it's only $20 an hour, I said, let me entertain this. So it's interesting because she's not an AA, she's not a counselor, right? So I met with her last night, and it was just cool because she's like, wow, you realize you're a miracle, right? And I'm thinking, all of you guys are miracles. We just forget how much of miracles we are. She tells me I need to apply for this job. So I decide I'm going to apply for it. And I go in this morning to work. And so Shannon, this woman that I work with, who I've encouraged to apply in the current position she's at, and I've encouraged her to do lots of things, and she's really just blossoming. I go in and I tell her, Shannon, I know I told you I wasn't going to apply for that job. And I said, but I want to be honest with you. I said, I have this career coach, and she's really encouraging me to do it. So I said, I wish you the best. I said, I don't want to feel like, I said, if you get it, I will, because whoever gets it is going to supervise the other. I said, so if you get it, I will happily work with you and for you. And Shannon got this big smile on her face this morning to me, and she said, Lisa, I am so happy that you found a you. She said, because you spend so much time encouraging other people. She said, I am so happy that you found a you. And that was so sweet to hear. Now, here's this woman I just told, I'm going for the same job you're going for. And so she said that. So, okay, I'm out of time, so I'm going to read something, then I'm going to shut up. So I love this. I can find it. Is this it? Here it is. This is out of Our Southern Friend, and this is just so pretty. And I'm going to read this. This is one of my favorites. There are periods of darkness, but the stars are shining no matter how black the night. There are disturbances, but I've learned that if I seek patience and open-mindedness, understanding will come. And with it, direction by the Spirit of God. The dawn comes, and with it, more understanding, the peace that passes understanding, and the joy of living that is not disturbed by the wildness of circumstances or people around me. Ever-increasing are the number of true friends. Ever-growing is the capacity for love. Ever widening is the horizon of understanding. And above all else comes a greater thankfulness to and a greater love for our Father in heaven. Isn't that beautiful? Anyway, thanks. I'm done.